This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 54. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. Anything new today, Rob?
You were mentioning domain names before we recorded. What's our domain name announcement?
The startupsfortherestofus.com domain is going to be 2 years old, I believe, at the end of this month.
La. Break out a cake and some candles. Man, I was looking through my domains last week, and I went through and dropped about 20 domains that I'd registered last year. The humanity when my domains come up for renewal, man, it's so painful. I think I have close to 100 domains, but most of them are active, like in one way or another. I just thought I would throw that out there because I get that question a lot. How many domain names do you own? And it's like, well, there's like 30 websites live, and then Wedding Toolbox has a bunch of custom domains that I buy for people. So those are in there. And then there's variations. Like we have micropreneur.com, and then we have micropreneur.com that just redirects to it for misspelling. Mm-hmm. And I have a couple misspellings of Hittail, because tail can be spelled T-A-I-L or T-A-L-E. The proper spelling is A-I-L for the long tail, but I have A-L-E that redirects to it and such. Anyways, How about you? Do you own a lot of domain names?
I own, I think, around 31. It's either 31 or 32. I forget which.
Yeah, I'm definitely not proud of owning a lot. I think obviously it's a waste of money and stuff that I registered all those, and I don't encourage. You know what I don't encourage people to do is to register. Someone will say, I'm going to start a company, and then they register the .com, .net, and .org. I just don't know that you need to do that. If you're going to be huge and raise funding, then yeah, go ahead and drop the money. But if you're going to have a lot of smaller businesses, I don't know that I see a lot of value in doing that.
I think it depends on whether it's for a product or for your company.
Mm. Oh, totally. Yeah, like with Audit Shark, since you plan to make it a big product, I would get all three for that.
Right. I forget whether I picked up .org. I know I picked up the .com and .net, and yeah. Part of that is because I wanted my website to be on the .com, and then the back end network of everything is all going to be on .net.
Got it. Oh, that's kind of nice. So, yeah.
So it's, I mean, because I'm not going to be using AuditShark.net for any kind of SEO or anything like that. And if somebody searches, they're going to end up at the .com anyway. It's not a big deal. The .net is just more or less going to be the login page. So that way I can have, you know, that primary domain and, you know, use that for the company and for everything else. And then I've got this back-end network. And I've always thought it'd be an interesting way to kind of segment your business. So you've got .com is your website, and that's the commercial front end for it. And then .net runs the actual application and everything else. And then you've got, that way you've got them separate, and you don't have to worry about having subdomains or anything like that. Not that subdomains are a big deal, but you can think of, especially for AutoShark, I've got this thing, you know, I'm kind of referring to different pieces of it as the Audit Shark network, because you're basically piping data into this network of stuff, and you know, it just, it kind of fits with the .net domain name.
Yeah, you know, one thing you need to be careful of is SSL certs.
Yep.
And if you try to do any type of JavaScript or cookie sharing between the two, because JavaScript is really paranoid security-wise about domains, and so are cookies. So as long as they never need to communicate with each other, as in you don't need a login page embedded in the .com. But I've run into this with someone who split it up over two domain names, and it was actually, they had some specific things they were trying to do, but it was actually really hard to make the two merge or even just communicate between one another on the front end. So right. Just be careful with that. You'll definitely need SSL certs for both of them, and we'll be able to do a wildcard, obviously.
I don't know if I need an SSL cert for both of them, though. I mean, because if somebody's going to come in and buy the product, they're going to do it over on the .net domain anyway.
Really? They're going to buy it on .net?
Yep.
Oh, man. I would figure that they would buy it through the .com, through your front-facing website.
I could have them do it there, I guess. I mean, the thing is, the .com domain is hosted on a Linux machine, and got everything that, you know, AutoShark is built on is all based in Azure.
Right,
so
okay.
I can't have them on the same physical machine regardless, you know, so I just said, I'll just have this whole domain off to myself. And I'd actually thought about having a separate subdomain for each customer anyway. I kind of canned that idea after a while, but I was going to let them choose their own subdomain, and it was going to be messy, so I just said the heck with it.
The other thing to think about with having them redirect over to .net to buy is you're really going to want to make sure Google and the other search engines don't crawl .NET because it'll confuse the engines. I mean, you're going to be splitting your page rank, basically. And you really don't want .NET, your .NET domain appearing in the search engines, it sounds like. So you're going to want to put a robots.txt and eliminate that stuff.
But they're not going to be able to because the entire application, you have to log in.
No, but you said there would be the public-facing purchase pages on the .NET site. So there will be something there. There'll be a receipt. There'll be a shopping cart. There'll be a buy now button. I mean, there'll be a handful of public pages there. I would guess would grow over time. I know that probably is not your initial vision, but I've never seen anyone. Well, I've just seen that one client do it. So I think it's an interesting idea. I would lean towards subdomains, but if you can make it work, you make it work.
Yeah, I could change it if I really need to. If I run into problems, it's not that big a deal.
So today, we're continuing with the cliffhanger from last episode. Last time, we talked about how we left our jobs, part one, in which Mike went through kind of the emotional process and the mindset process of leaving the full-time salaried grind. And today, we're doing part two, which is where I tell my story. You had asked me a question at the end of the last episode, and I left it for this one. Do you remember what that question was?
The idea was that one of the things that I'm driving to at this point is time independence, because I have location independence, but not necessarily time independence. And you had said that you were very risk averse and, you know, you really valued that time independence. And I was kind of wondering, where did you kind of get that start from? I mean, was there something that you started out doing and said, well, I don't have time or location independence, that kind of drove you in that direction?
Absolutely. And it was called salaried employment. Seriously. So, you know, I got a salary job right out of college and I was working for a construction company. I was a project manager. And I realized right away that working 9 to 5 was for the birds, man. I needed to figure out a way to get out of this. And I knew that wasn't going to do it till I retired. And my goal the whole time, like I kept thinking, oh man, if I was just a consultant, if I was self-employed, you know, working for other people, like writing code for them or whatever. And I wasn't even writing code at this point, but I was just imagining like being a consultant and being able to work out of coffee shops is the way to go. That's the goal. And I had that for several years until I achieved it. And then I realized, oh, I totally deluded myself. Like it was this fallacy that I thought I would have all this freedom. And I did have location independence at that point, but I realized a huge piece of my actual desire was to also have time independence. And so that's where the rest of the story, you know, that's where I realized like I need to now go from consulting to how do I get time independence? That's been with software products. So I think I want to circle back, and there's three things that as I wrote this out, I realized three things that people will notice. One is that I am pretty risk averse. It doesn't mean I don't take any risks, but I always tend to have a backup plan and realize if this fails, it won't ruin me because I would stress out too much. Now, I also have two kids and a mortgage and a wife, and I just have a lot of responsibility. So I tend to take that pretty seriously.
From my perspective, that has changed a lot for me. I used to be a lot more open to risk, and I'm much less open to risk at this point because of the exact same reasons.
Yep. Once you have a family and you're kind of taking care of other folks. Now, granted, these days, my wife, you know, was getting her PhD during most of the story I'm going to tell today. And it was just about 2 years ago that she started working and that she started making money. And that actually relieved a good chunk of burden off me because I didn't feel like I was a sole breadwinner. And you are still, right? You're the sole breadwinner. So it has a big impact knowing that if you don't bring in money, that the whole family is going to suffer for it. I think the other two things that people will notice is that I worked a lot of nights and weekends, and I don't think there's any way around working your ass off to achieve any of this stuff. Like you can't just read blogs and Hacker News and assume it's going to happen. It was hours and hours of nights and weekends, and I know it was the same for you as well. And then the last thing was learning by doing. I just kept diving into new things that were, you know, fairly scary or that I thought could be a big time waster. And I did waste a lot of time on some things that failed, but the ones that turned out were enough to get me what I wanted, my end goal of location and time independence and enjoying what I want to do for a living. Anyways, back to the story. So I was working for a construction company and I was slated, you know, my dad had worked there for 30 something years and I was slated for management and they wanted me to rise the ranks and such, but I hated it. Like I didn't enjoy construction. It was not a fun gig. And I started teaching myself Perl and HTML at night. And I had graduated with a degree in computer engineering, but you know, they don't actually teach you much that's applicable, right? I learned that I wallowed kind of in sadness or in depression for like 18 months at that job because I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to disappoint my dad and all these people that I'd known. And finally, I realized no one is going to make me happy. Like no one's going to change this situation. I can either shut up and do this for 25, 30 years, and I would have made good money. I would have been, you know, the VP or the president or some high up rank in this company. And it was a big company. It was several hundred million dollars. And I knew that all the people, most of the people on the board, I knew all the presidents and CEOs. They had watched me growing up, and they were waiting for me to graduate from college to come work for them. I mean, I was set, and I had a really hard decision to make. And I realized that long term, I wouldn't be happy, even though I may have a crap load of money and I may have, you know, a bunch of power in this company, that I had to make a break. And it was really hard. That was a lesson that I learned. And I think that impacted me for years in learning, like, you have to take control of the reins. No one is going to make that decision for you. So then I went and did what may be the funnest salary job I ever had in my life. And I worked for a .com. They were in Sacramento. And I was just coding. I learned, like, it was a consulting firm. And we were working for all the .coms. And so I learned like 5 programming languages in 9 months, because it was whatever they wanted you to code in, you coded in. And so I would start a project, that I'd buy a book on Perl or PHP or Cold Fusion or Classic ASP, you know, the gamut. I learned all that stuff, and it was so much fun. And I realized, you know, learning is a big part of what makes me enjoy things. So I bought a house, and within 60 days, the .com went out of business. That was brutal. It was our first house, and I was 25 years old. I wasn't that stressed about it. But the CEO of the company was like, hey, you know, we were about a 17 to 20 person company at the time. And he said, I have enough work for myself and 3 of you guys. And he contacted me and said, you know, I want you to be one of those guys. And he wanted us to contract for him. And it was exactly what you said. Suddenly overnight, he was willing to pay us twice as much, but we didn't get, you know, it was hourly. So we didn't get paid if you didn't work, and you didn't get benefits, and you worked from home. There was no office. And so he just basically cut out a lot of overhead and then shared some of that with us, kept some of it for himself. And I turned him down. I was like, no, I'm not a contractor. Like, there's too much risk, was what was going on in my head.
Really?
I was like, I want a salary job. That's what I'm going to do. I'm a salary guy. Isn't this funny? Like, to hear it now. This is 11 years ago. I just had a lot to learn from there. I tried to look for a job for months, and I couldn't find one. It was 2001, so I guess it was 10 years ago, and there was no work. Over those months, he kept emailing and calling, and he would finally like, well, you know, what if you just do this on the side while you're looking for a job? And that's what I was like, okay, I'll do that. So I did like 20 hours one week and then 30 hours the next, and pretty soon I was basically contracting for him full time. And I was, he stuck around, you know, and convinced me to do it. And then I realized, like, what was I thinking? This is pretty damn cool. I work from home. Like you said, you know, you make a lot more money, at least on paper up front. You know, you'd have to save for taxes and pay healthcare and all that stuff. But it was quite an experience.
But you have to pay for taxes anyway, and you generally have to pay for your healthcare anyway. I mean, a lot of times the company will pick that up, but they only pick up a percentage of it.
Yeah, no, but back then, my healthcare was fully covered at my employer, and then I suddenly had to pay out of pocket. Now, luckily, we were young, and it was 10 years ago. Healthcare was literally like 25% of the cost it is today. But yeah, so that was my first taste where I was like, this is the life. And I loved it. And it was, again, working from home. And I remember the first day that I didn't have to go into an office, I got up and I had some coffee and I drove to Borders. I didn't know what to do with myself. And I was so just having fun. That lasted for about a year, which is typical with me. I got bored. I realized that you make good money as a consultant, but you basically run on a hamster wheel. During that year, not only had I grown bored of building stuff for other people, but I grew bored of projects would end and then we'd have no work for a few weeks. It was never a very long time, but I would instantly start stressing about it and being like, what if there's no work for 3 months? I have savings, but I'm just going to burn through it. Why am I doing it? You know, I make more money, but I'm going to piss it away. And so it was always this ongoing hamster wheel. And so I started thinking to myself, like, I'm 25, 26. Am I going to be doing this when I'm 50? And I realized that it's like you, I wanted to do something that I could leverage. So I actually looked at all my options, and I day traded for a while. I'd like broke even, you know, over weeks and weeks of doing it. And I realized that there was a whole lot to learn about that I wasn't willing to learn. And then the other thing is I bought real estate. So I started buying real estate in LA. We moved to LA and I bought several properties down there. And that was going to be my out for a while. I thought you had to just stack up a bunch of assets and either sell them for a bunch of money or just live off the residuals. It was a good plan until, of course, the real estate market popped. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's when I realized that as entrepreneurs, I feel like we're a little more in control of our fates than when you're buying into an investment that is so has such market forces that can send it up and down.
So when was this? You said you dabbled in real estate.
I started buying, you know, my second, third, fourth house in 2003, I think is when I bought the second, and then bought basically three more over the next 3 years. And some of them were with, I bought one with my dad, and then we bought one with some folks, some friends we know. So it was actually quite fun. And I did it. That was my hobby, like that in the evenings and weekends. When I was, you know, not doing other stuff, I would research the market, and I was really into that, you know, as an idea to break free from salaried employment. But that was a long road, man. It's like, it's really hard with real estate because you have to get this massive amount of capital. So you either take out a bunch of mortgages, in which case you're managing a ton of paperwork and you can only borrow so much. And it's pretty complex, you know, unless you're going to really get into it. And I was into it pretty good. I took a bunch of tests to prepare for my real estate exam. I was going to get a realtor license and do it myself to cut out the commissions. I'm an entrepreneur, dude. Like, I want to do stuff for myself. And I wanted to learn it as much as I wanted to do it for the 3%. This is LA in 2004, 2005. These houses were between 400 and 700 grand each. So you look at 3% and you're talking 12 to 20 grand per deal. And I was like, ah, totally. Like, I'll take the test costs, you know, $1,000 to take or something. And I knew that, you know, I figured I could pass. I'm pretty good at standardized tests. So I figured I'd pass it the first time. And I was just like, this is a no-brainer to do this. Plus, once I did that, then I got access to the MLS. And it actually gave me an advantage when walking into a deal, frankly. But I realized a couple things. One, we moved out of California right towards the end of that. And suddenly, I was going to get a California realtor's license, you know, and it doesn't apply anywhere else. And two, the market started tanking. This was towards 2007, or started flattening out and then started going down. I watched that and realized, like, wow, this is not, I mean, this may work in 20 years, but what am I going to do for now to stay interested and to break free of this consulting work that I was now doing? That's when I actually did go back to, I struggled with, should I be a consultant? Should I do salaried employment? And every time I was done with a project, I would ask that same question again. And so I went back to salaried employment for a couple years during that time. And while I was in salaried employment, that's when I bought my first product. I was trying to build one, and then I just saw this .NET forum software for sale on eBay. I was like, well, of course, you know, I'll just buy this because I don't have the hundreds of hours to build it. Thought it would just be this kind of a slam dunk to get started and a good learning experience. And of course, I found out I didn't know crap about marketing software, that I knew how to build it really well. But the marketing was like this totally different thing, right?
It's like a black box. I mean, you have absolutely no idea what's in there or how it works or what to do with it once you've got it in your hands.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I didn't realize that. Like, suddenly I had this software and I was like, what do I do? I had no idea what to do next, you know? And so we've talked about this. That's when I went and bought AdWords and dropped, I think it was $1,500 in a month and didn't make any money. It was just trying different things and it sold reasonably well, but if I recall, it was $200 to $300 a month that it was selling. And it wasn't selling that much when I bought it. So I actually improved it, but pretty quickly I realized I'm just not that excited about this. And so I went on and I built a couple other small apps. I launched them. One of them is called feedshot.com. It's not super important what they do, but it was just the idea that for each one, it was like 4 months of nights and weekends scrambling for an idea, trying to launch while I'm working a salary job. And they didn't work out, but I learned huge lessons from them about marketing. Each time I learned like, oh, so you actually need to solve a problem people have. And then it was like, oh, so I actually need to know how to reach people who have this problem. Honestly, those days of just churning away for a few years is what I think led to the ultimate, my first success, which was .NET Invoice. And that was kind of my flagship product. I had thought about building .NET invoicing software, and I came upon some dudes on a forum who were having real trouble. They'd already built it. It was a nice app, had a lot of Ajax in it. And at the time, it looked really sexy. And they were just like, we don't know how to market this thing. Who wants to partner with us? And I was basically like, if you'll sell, like, I don't want to partner with someone, you know, especially someone I didn't know. So I said, if you'll sell it to me, I'll do it. So I bought it and I overpaid. And as soon as I got it, I realized there were a gazillion bugs they hadn't talked about. There were a bunch of pissed off customers.
Seems like a recurring theme with you.
Well, no, it's just that I've told the story so many times. That's the difference these days is when I do an acquisition, I may have a bunch of stuff to clean up, but there hasn't been any surprises this time around because I've done so many now that I'll just say I'm in a much better situation these days in terms of being prepared for fixing things.
Well, I think that you know the questions to ask to kind of alleviate some of the more obvious issues, but... And I do this too. I think that most programmers in general do this. They tend to underestimate how long something is going to take to do. And that's just it's human nature. Oh, I can do this. I'm good enough that I can do this in, 20 minutes or an hour or whatever. And there are things that you don't know. And until you get into it, you didn't know that those things were there or that they were a problem. And they start introducing all these additional stuff that you have to do. And suddenly something you thought was only going to take an hour suddenly took four.
Yeah, but I think the difference now is when that happens, I say, oh yeah, cool, the other shoe has dropped. I expected this. I'm totally not surprised when that happens. Whereas that first one with .NET Invoice, I was like panicked. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to spend so much time. I didn't count on this. Whereas now I genuinely say, whatever I think it's going to take, pretty much triple it. I know that I'm going to run into a bunch of stuff and I need a bunch of contingencies to handle that. It's purely experience and knowing that it's my whatever 20th acquisition or something. I don't know about every surprise that's going to come along, but I guess I'm not as surprised by them as I once was. Yeah, .NET Invoice was kind of an alpha. It had 26 showstopper bugs when I acquired it that I didn't know about. And so I fixed them in about 3 weeks. Sales started doing well. And I kind of just let it go because I moved to New Haven for my wife's schooling. And I met a couple MBA students from Yale. And they were just going to graduate. And we got together and we tried to launch 3 different funded ideas. We tried to get, they had to do a bunch of angels at Yale. And we almost got funding for one of them. And then we applied for Y Combinator. Have I ever told you that?
I think I knew that. I don't know if you really told me the story about behind it.
Yeah. I mean, basically we hadn't, and I don't even remember which of the ideas it was. There were some good ideas. Some of them came from the MBAs and they were, they were sharp folks. But yeah, we applied for Y Combinator. I think it was 3 of us. And we got past the first round and we got into the phone interview round where they like have past YC founders interview people. And so we talked to, it was like a travel startup that was in the class from the previous year. And it was one of the founders and he interviewed the 3 of us. And then we didn't make it any further. But we were planning to, we're talking about moving to Boston if we needed to. Frankly, after a year, I was consulting this whole time, which was going well. I was making a lot of money, like the most money I'd ever made in my life. And New Haven, Connecticut was so cheap to live in that I just started, I was banking a ton of money. But everything else was a bust. All my nights and weekends had been spent going after these funded ideas. And that was what I thought you had to do. And this is 2007. And so at the end of this year, we're moving now. We moved to Boston because my wife got a postdoc there. And at the end of the year, I looked in this .NET Invoice PayPal account, and all I'd been doing was answering support emails, and I hadn't done another release or anything. And there was $25,000 in the PayPal account.
Wow.
And I realized, what am I doing chasing after these things? If I really want this time independence, if I really want products to get me out of consulting, go after this, like grow .NET Invoice or have 3 or 4 more .NET Invoices and be done with it. Because I could totally, the amount of time I was spending on .NET Invoice was not, I could totally have spent, 4 times that much, 5 times that much. That's when I realized that you don't really need to go big. Going big is cool. Going big is fun. It's hip. The way that it has a lot more certainty of it actually happening, at least in my opinion, is to go small and to look for a market that has a need and test that need and then build an app for the market.
So when you were looking at the money that was coming in from .NET Invoice and you were looking around at these other things that were either for sale on different websites, I think you mentioned in the past that you bought justbeachtowels.com and ncmsthemer.com. What sort of things were you looking at in terms of potential revenue for these things? I mean, did you just kind of gather that from the experience that you had with Flogs and FeedShot to figure out, okay, well, this is how much I could think I can turn this into in order to get to that goal?
That's a good question, actually. I think the first thing I'll say is I kind of looked at my options at the time and I was making really good money consulting. And I thought to myself, I can build another app like .NET Invoice, but it's going to take a lot of time, right? To build .NET Invoice was probably 500 man hours previous guys had put in. I realized that I probably wasn't going to stop consulting for a few months and build something. And if you have that time, then building it is perfectly acceptable and, it's a good way. But I realized I had more money than time. So I realized I wanted to do another acquisition. And that's when I went on, it was SitePoint at the time. And I just started looking around and looking at what things were for sale that I thought could make enough money to get me to my goal of time independence. Like you said, I bought justbeachtowels.com, which was at the time it was nothing. It was just a site that ranked high in Google for beach towels. And it wasn't selling anything. It was like four or five flat HTML pages. And so to me, it was an adventure. It was like, I knew that it was all about marketing. I saw that with .NET Invoice, once I kind of hit upon some good marketing things, that it sold well on its own. And so I realized that if I could do the same for Just Beach Towels and CMS Themer, that potentially I could travel a similar path. Now, I've since sold both of those guys. They fit into my portfolio early on, and they were, you know, they high revenue, but they were a higher kind of maintenance time that I needed to invest. But they were part of why I quit consulting ultimately. And totally am glad that I bought them.
So basically use them to kind of leapfrog you to a certain point, kind of advance what you were trying to do to get to that time independence.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I didn't know that at the time. I was really buying them because they looked like sites that could make a good chunk of money and that I could learn from. I think those were the two things I was looking for. I needed the money so that I could quit consulting, and I needed to learn from them so that I could get better at the whole owning product thing. I really wanted to learn more about marketing because I had realized pretty early that like that was the difference between all my other ideas and the one that had worked, is that I learned the market and I learned how to market.
So when you acquired these different products, though, especially early on, did you have an idea of how to assess the value of them, what your expectations were in terms of how much revenue you could bring in from them? So, I mean, if something was already bringing in $100, did you think you could turn it into $200 or $500 or $1,000? What sort of things, you know, went into those decisions?
So Just Beach Towels was bringing in $0, and I just saw that it was ranking number 6 in Google for a generic keyword. Anyways, it was on the first page, and I was like, the guy isn't even selling anything. It's a cheap site, and I bought it with the intention of setting up an e-commerce site, and that's what I ultimately did, and I had no idea how much I would sell, if it would be 1,000 or 10,000 in beach towels. I had no idea how hard it would be to find dropship beach towels, just had no concept. It was purely a leap. And so some people say, wow, that's risky, you know, you're taking a big risk. But it's like, no, because if Just Beach Towels tanked, I was out the purchase price and some time. You know, it may have been adventurous to devote to spending months and months of nights and weekends learning the business and setting it up. But to me, the learning is fun. And to me, the learning carries over to every app that I own now. Like, that is why I've been able to quit consulting, is because I put in all that time on that idea. And so, yeah, with CMS Themer, same thing. It was making, I can't remember what it was making. It was maybe $2,000 a month when I bought it, but it was all manual. Like, the dude was doing all the work himself, and it was kind of a PSD slicing is what it was. And so I outsourced the work and made it a little more automated, but I didn't know how much I'd be able to grow it. And in fact, with that one, I think I grew it a little bit, but I pretty much maintained it. But the fact that I automated it made it a much more valuable business because you didn't have to do the work yourself. Buying those two, which, you know, again, I've since sold them, but I later bought WeddingToolbox.com. I bought ApprenticeLymanJobs.com, which I still own. And that was the realization that I really wanted to build a portfolio and increase my recurring income. And I watched that recurring income like a hawk. I kept it very separate from my consulting income because I was trying to figure out at what point I could quit this consulting work. I was really focused on that goal. So every hour that I worked, like nights and weekends and such, it was focused on that goal of getting me to the day that I could stop consulting. And so I actually looked at how much I was making from consulting, and it was a lot more than I needed to live, right? My budget for living was, I don't remember, it was like 50% or 60% of what I was making from consulting. And so I realized that I didn't actually have to earn as much as I was earning. I just needed to earn as much as I needed to live from these products. I kind of cut things to the bone. We sold a car, and I sold $5,000 of stuff on eBay and Craigslist. I just kind of took it to the max and really decided to cut expenses and try to increase these product earnings. Frankly, when I hit 70% of what I needed to live, it wasn't 70% of my consulting earnings, but it was 70% of, you know, what I thought I needed to live, I stopped consulting. And I had a chunk of money in the bank. And I remember the thoughts that went through my head that day, like the last day I consulted, and when I got up the next Monday and said, wow, I don't have to do anything. No one's telling me what to do. I don't have any clients anymore. And it was a huge mental shift for me. All of a sudden, I had a lot of free time to spend on working on these products. And it went from nights and weekends to suddenly I had way, way more time than I had spent ever working on products. It was a good feeling.
You mentioned that when you got to 70% of what you needed to live, you stopped consulting. And one of the things that I've noticed, or at least I noticed a couple of years ago, was that the more money that I had coming in, the more likely I was to not necessarily pay attention to how much was coming in and maybe spend money on stuff that I didn't necessarily need. And I think that's probably a trap that people can easily fall into. So it's sort of a lessons learned or a takeaway from this is that that's something that you have to be careful of, because you can start wasting money on things that you just absolutely don't need, and then you get to a point where you want to do something else and you have to take a serious look at how much money you're spending and where.
I think that's a really good point. I have a lot of friends who have either bought houses that they can afford now, but if they want to stop working and work less, or make a little less money, that they can't. They've kind of trapped themselves into these higher earning careers, and the higher earning career may not be something they want to do forever. And you're right. You can easily trap yourself into a job that you don't want. And if you're able to get out from under those things or not buy them in the first place, you really do increase your chances of kind of getting to that point of freedom, time and location independence.
Another one of the things you'd said was when you hit 70% of what you needed to live, you stopped consulting, and you said you had money in the bank. But at the very beginning, you said you were also very risk averse. I mean, how many months worth of that 30%, extra 30% that you needed, did you have in the bank when you decided to just stop consulting?
I have no idea. I genuinely don't remember. I'm sure it was a lot. I imagine it was at least 6 months of 30%. What I remembered thinking was, I need to do this. This was one of those times when I said, what is the worst that will happen? The worst that will happen if I don't make this work is that I will go back to consulting. And I know that I can find consulting work. And that was it. So I am risk averse, but I was also realistic about, I wasn't going to lose the house. I wasn't going to bankrupt us. I genuinely believed that I could find work if I needed it. So it may have been 3 months, 6 months, I don't know. I just knew that the time had come. And I remember when I hit that 70% mark, I was really excited. And I think the next month it actually dropped to like 63% or something. And I was like, oh no, I've made the wrong decision. Sure enough, that was a fluke. And the more time I put into it and the more stuff I learned, I think I acquired another app. And pretty soon I hit 100% within probably 6 months. And it was creeping up that whole time. And then obviously way beyond that point now, which has been really cool to have the freedom of this, the time independence I was seeking and the location independence. And early on, I admit, when I had first quit consulting, I did stress about money. I did stress about hitting my number every month. And I haven't worried about that in a while, because I've pretty consistently, hit it now for probably, I don't think I've missed it in 18 months now. That's in general my story. There's obviously a lot since then, because I think that leaves off in 2008, but we just want to talk about how we left our jobs, not our whole career path and such.
So I think an important question that people are probably thinking to themselves right now, though, is when you decided that you were going to stop consulting because you had 70% of what you needed to live, what did your wife say?
She was okay with it, because I had been communicating with her during the entire process, and it wasn't this big shock that I wanted to leave consulting. It was like years of me talking to her about it, talking about how to do it. She saw me buying the real estate. She saw me buying the apps. She saw the successes. I would show her the financials of what these apps were doing. She was on board. She had confidence that I could do it by that time, because I had had so many failures. She knew about all the failures along the way too. And she was kind of like, yeah, we're like 7 years into this stuff by then. She was okay with it, because now if I had said that the very first app I launched, she would have thought I was nuts. But by that time, she had confidence in what I could do. So if I hadn't done that and it was all of a sudden some shocker, I'm gonna quit consulting, this thing that's totally paid for us for years. Maybe that year she was a postdoc, so she was not making, that was the first year she had made money and she wasn't making very much. So there was no way that she could have even come close to supporting us.
Very cool.
So I think I want to end cap this with the fact that I just acquired Hittail, right? I acquired this app about a month ago. And as I talked about on the last episode, it's requiring me to ramp up again. I haven't been working a lot, which has been great, because I have a young child, who's just 1 year old now. Some people might be thinking, like, why the hell did you do that? You know, why would you go out and force yourself to go back to the grind or go back to being encumbered to an app? And I don't look at it that way at all. Like I really was feeling like I need a new chapter and like I need something new to learn. And I had been asking myself for about a year, what's next? And I had that written on a post-it and I put it on my monitor. What's next for me? What's next? And so that's why I've done Hittail, is because I'm really excited about it. And it may go beyond, you know, the micropreneur stuff and the smaller ideas that I've had, but geez, I've learned so much from doing those things. There's no way I would have tackled Hittail without the knowledge that I've learned from everything that's come before, frankly.
Yeah, I think the guys from the TechSync podcast had asked us about both Audit Shark and Hittail, and they basically pointed out up front and said, look, these aren't really micropreneur endeavors. What are you guys thinking?
And we said that the micropreneur approach is perfectly valid. And it is, in my opinion, it is the best way to start making money on a product. And it's the most risk-averse way, frankly. I think it's the one that will succeed most of the time compared to doing something like Audit Shark or Hittail, or a little higher risk. They're bigger ideas with more moving parts and more things that can break or fail, both in marketing and, you know, and technology-wise. But we've both been doing this for, what, 10 years at least, right? I think you launched your first thing in 99 or 2000. I had one that I did in 99 that I've never talked about. But so I've been doing it a long time too. And it's like, A, I think you and I have years of experience doing this. And we're ready to take on this challenge. I know perfectly well that what we're doing has a little more risk than other stuff we've done in the past. But I also think we're enjoying it maybe more than doing another small idea.
Oh, totally. I mean, for Audit Shark, I absolutely love getting in there and getting my hands dirty on the stuff that I'm actually doing. And it's not just the development side that's fun. I mean, it's the marketing side as well. I mean, I'm sure I'm building it from scratch, and it would be a lot cheaper to buy it if somebody had built something similar or something that I wanted to. But I enjoy getting in there and getting my hands dirty with all of it. I mean, from beginning to end, from the development to the marketing, it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I think that's more for both of us what we're looking at these days. We're just at a different place. We're not that entrepreneur 10 years ago, you know, our first day, so to speak, on the job of entrepreneurship. And so we're at a different place and ready to kind of take a bigger risk and learn more things. I mean, there's more likelihood we're going to fail because these are bigger ideas, but I'm super excited about the prospect of it.
Well, the other thing is I think that these are probably also both Audit Shark and Hittail are probably higher price points than, you know, a lot of some of the other things that we've done.
Sure.
Both in terms of the recurring revenue aspects of them and, you know, just the actual dollar amount per customer anyway.
Yeah.
Probably isn't necessarily a bigger risk in that sense, but certainly the opportunity for anything to go belly up.
Right. And I also think both of our ideas that we're working on they're much less automatable. They're harder to automate. Like there's going to be more high touch sales, face to face interaction, phone call support, that kind of stuff. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Like I'm prepared for it, and I'm sure you are too. You're willing to do it. And maybe when I was working a full-time job, I didn't want to do that, but we're geared up and we have hopefully realistic expectations of what it's going to take to make these things work.
You know, until you mentioned it, I hadn't really been on board with the whole idea of phone support, so I don't know about that.
All right. No, and that's fine. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I guess I've thought about pretty actively that I will probably put a phone number up there and do it and see how it goes. And if it really helps me get more customers and help support people, then I won't do it forever myself, right? I'll do it for a month or two to learn the ropes, and then I will find someone good who I can outsource it to. But that kind of thing that goes outside of our comfort zone, that's what I was thinking.
Well, I was thinking the thought that had come to me about, it was probably 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'll run this idea past you. One thing I thought about was because Audit Shark is, as you said, much higher price point, probably higher touch sales and everything else. What I had thought about was, okay, there are going to be people who probably want to talk to somebody on the phone, or there are going to be situations where they have a particular problem and you really probably need to talk to them. What I had thought about doing was only doing support calls of any kind on like Tuesdays and Thursdays, and that's it. And maybe only in the afternoon. If you wanted to talk to somebody about a support issue, you had to wait until either Tuesday or Thursday afternoon.
Right. So office hours. I think if you go enterprise, that's not going to work at all.
Well, you'd still get email support on other times, but if you wanted phone support, then that's the time.
I don't know, man. As a customer, if someone has an issue on a Monday or a Saturday and their stuff's down or it's not working and they have a consultant waiting on it, I guess you're saying they could email you. To me, it depends on the market you're selling into and the expectation you set up front. I think that's a big part of it. It sounds weird to me. If you said there's only phone support for, you know, 4 hours twice a week, that sound, I've never heard anyone doing that. And it sounds like a little small.
It's unorthodox.
Yeah, it is. But it's not to say you couldn't give it a shot. If you're doing in-person sales, you're going to see that reaction pretty quickly and be able to change it. And having no phone support may be better than having 2 days a week, 3 hours a day. It might be. I don't know without seeing the market you're selling into or talking to customers. I think that's going to be your tale.
Yeah, I hadn't actually decided that this was what I was going to do. It came to mind one day. I don't remember what I was doing. I said, I wonder what would happen if you did this.
No, I think it's a really interesting idea.
Well, if any of you listeners out there feel so inclined, feel free to come to the website and leave some comments and weigh in on that. It'd be interesting to hear what other people think about that.
Or you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690. Or you can email it to us in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to it in iTunes or via RSS. A full transcript is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.